This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Flagship Victory, written by B.V. Larson and David Van Dyke, performed by Mark Boyette. Part 1. Defender. The evil, soul-crushing mutuality had been overthrown by my liberation. My troops and followers, my brave men and women, Strakers Breakers, aided by allies such as the Unmutuals, the Ruxins, the Saxons, and many defectors, now stood victorious astride the trash heap of history that was its collectivist paradise. No longer would its tyranny hold more than 1,000 worlds in thrall. The new Earthen Republic was born. Next, I would turn my attention to my former regime and nation, the 100 Worlds. Long the enemy of the Mutuality, though their common citizenry was kept from this knowledge, the Huns were already seizing territory from our republic and seemed unwilling to consider peace between the two great empires of mankind. Therefore, with the help of faithful friends and allies, I resolved to force them to talk. But before I could implement my intentions, before I could set my plans in motion, before I could even begin my honeymoon with my new wife, the commander of my fleets, Carla Straker, nay Engels, the insectoid Opters intervened. They'd first tried to addict me to their nectar. Next, they utterly destroyed our largest shipyards at Krasnovol. Now we raced to Murmorsk to confront the nest ships there. A History of Galactic Liberation by Derek Barnes Straker, 2860 A.D. Atlantis, capital of the 100 Worlds, Carstairs Corporation headquarters, 1 year ago. The 100 Worlds consisted of a bright cluster of stars, rare jewels in the velvet black of space. These star systems had become humanity's home, even if old Earth still made the claim of origin. Like many other human-occupied systems, Earth was under the sway of the alien Hawk, the soldiers of the Mutuality. It was unrecognizable to any independent, civilized person. At the center of the 100 Worlds, like a blue gem in a treasure chest, the planet Atlantis shone brightest of all. Unlike Earth, Atlantis bustled with energy and industry. She was the economic and political crossroads of the 100 Worlds, and she served them all as their capital. On Atlantis, all things met, all paths intersected, and all power was conglomerated. Megacorp owner Billingsworth M. Carstairs VI told himself these unsalable truths every day of his rich life. Carstairs had commanded a host of underlings to gather for a high-level executive meeting. He always started such meetings wearing a stern frown, even when he was happy. His father, Big Bill Carstairs, had taught him that trick as a child. "Start from a position of dissatisfaction, my boy," he'd said, "and your employees will work all the harder to please you. They'll cherish your every smile, which you can then bestow like rare gifts." Big Bill had been right. May he rest in peace. Over the last decade, Carstairs Corporation had grown from the third largest conglomerate in the 100 Worlds into the biggest, and it was now double the size of any other megacorp. The best part was the old man had had the decency to die before retiring, turning over his controlling interest to his son and namesake, Billy. Of course, nobody outside the Carstairs family called him Billy anymore, not if they wanted to keep their jobs. The power of Carstairs meant Billy had parliament ministers in his pocket, and plenty of fat government contracts. In fact, they'd just given him one of the fattest, which was why he had called today's meeting. Stepping into the meeting chamber, Billy heard the room fall silent for a moment. All eyes fell to him, and his frown deepened in response.
"Welcome, sir,"
his CEO, Romy Gardell, gushed as she moved aside from her position at the head of the table. As his most trusted underling and lover on demand, Gardell knew he was in a good mood, despite his forbidding appearance. "Thank you, Romy," he said. "Everyone take your seats. Ladies and gentlemen, I have good news. The Defense Committee has approved funding for the Victory Project. In fact, they were so impressed with the prototype and so worried by the unfortunate military disaster at Corinth." Here, Carstairs released a broad, genuine smile and a chuckle, prompting sycophantic laughter from his underlings, "that they doubled the budget and tripled our potential bonus for commissioning the lead ship on time." "No constitutional problems?" asked Mike Rollins, the corporation's senior legal advisor. "How did they get around Section 4.3? "The Declaration of Rights." Carstairs chuckled again. "The Supreme Judiciary provided an official opinion that anything less than a full brain is mere tissue, with no more human rights than a transplanted heart or kidney, as long as it was harvested legally. A few tweaks to the involuntary organ donor laws necessary for the war effort under the Loyalist Act, you see, and thousands of brains became available, as long as they've lost certain vital functions, the poor souls. One slip of a scalpel, and oh my, how unfortunate, with a generous settlement for the families, of course." The board members briefly changed their expressions to match Carstairs's own, a moment of crocodile-tiered sorrow. Carstairs continued, "The Loyalist Act gives the government all the authority it needs to identify and confiscate the remains for research purposes, and to classify all that research, does it not, Mr. Rollins?"
"It does."
"So we're cleared to proceed." Carstairs clapped his hands in satisfaction. "If these new flagships prove successful, not only may they allow our brave forces to achieve new gains, but the program can eventually expand to the civilian sector, where Victory-style AIs can be used for a wide variety of applications." He frowned significantly at Rollins. "Our patent suites are comprehensive."
"Unassailable, sir," the attorney said.
"Oh, eventually other megacorps will find a way to legally use brain parts to create stable AIs, as it's the only approach that has ever kept a machine AI from madness. But the controllers tell me we'll have a good 15 years of market dominance. And undoubtedly a large rise in the value of everyone's stock options." Carstairs clapped his hands once more. "Excellent. I'll expect weekly reports on the project. Carry on." He turned to go and then looked back over his shoulder. "Oh, Romy, drop by my office when you're done here."
"Yes, sir,"
she said with just a hint of extra color in her perfectly cut face. Carstairs found that money and power were always the best aphrodisiacs, and since he'd just promised Romy more of each, well, best to strike while the iron was hot. Very hot. He also had the latest pharmaceutical aphrodisiacs available, guaranteed to produce maximum performance with minimum side effects. His executive bedroom was about to get a workout. Chapter 1. Murmursk System, New Earthen Republic. Admiral Derek Straker, mech suit pilot and self-styled liberator of humanity, gripped the backrest of Commodore Carla Engel's command chair. He stared at the enormous hologram projected above the battleship Indomitable's gargantuan bridge. It showed a bewildering swirl of warships locked in mortal combat. Indomitable had just arrived at Murmursk, the recently overthrown Mutualities, now the New Earthen Republic's, second largest fleet base and military shipyards. Straker and Engels both expected the strange insectoid opters and their carrier-like nest ships to strike there next, after apparently destroying the larger main base at Krasnovol. Their guess was right. Straker's hope that Indomitable and other Republic forces could catch the opters in the act had panned out. His message drones had directed all available warships to assemble at Murmursk and engage at the senior commander's discretion. Indomitable's slow side-space transit speed meant she arrived well after the other ships. "Who's in command of our forces?" Straker asked. Tixban, the ship's octopoid Ruxin sensors officer, replied, "It appears Commodore Gray has assumed that position." Straker saw Engels nod with satisfaction. Despite a rocky start, the crusty, older Ellen Gray had become a solid sister-in-arms to them both. "Highlight enemy battle positions," Engels ordered. Tixban brushed his sub-tentacle clusters across the console, refining the hologram view to illustrate his words.
"Six Opter-Nest ships are grouped here, about halfway between the star and the edge of flat space. Their combat drones are approaching the inner planets and shipyards."
"How many drones?"
"At least 50,000. There may be more. I am still collating data."
Straker's brow furrowed.
"How? 50,000? How can we fight that many?"
Engels stood to walk closer to the hologram. "During transit here, I studied all the data we collected. Individually, the drones are weak. Many of them are no more than a small fighter with an expendable pilot and one weapon, usually a beam of some sort. I believe those are crewed by the dog bees, the least intelligent kind of opters. The next, less numerous class up is a larger fighter, probably piloted by the ant-like technicians you saw. These have a mix of two or three small weapons. More punch, more survivable. Above that, they have attack ships comparable to ours, with single larger weapons likely piloted by WASP warriors." Straker grunted in acknowledgement.
"What forces do we have?"
Tixban highlighted the icons.
"Commodore Gray's flagship, the Super Dreadnought Coriad, 5 dreadnoughts, 19 battle cruisers, 35 heavy cruisers, 60 lights, and over 400 escorts from destroyers down to corvettes. Everything that could converge from nearby systems."
"Attack ships?"
45 from the local forces, along with 2 monitors and a handful of escorts. They also appear to be trying to launch some of the warships under repair, but they're unlikely to make the battle ready soon enough."
"Those attack ships won't last long. The monitors may survive. How long until the Opter forces hit them?"
2 hours.
"And Commodore Gray's ships?"
"About 3 hours until her fastest ships can join the battle."
Straker slammed his palm on the chair's back. "And there's no way for Indomitable to reach the fight in time."
"No,"
said Engels. "We need 12 hours minimum simply to reassemble the sections." The battleship, too large to transit through side space in one piece, had to break apart into 16 sections every time it traveled from star to star.
"Damn it all. We can't just sit here aboard Indomitable as spectators."
"We have no other choice," said Tixban.
"Oh, yes, we do. Indy? Zaxby?" Straker called into the air, presuming the artificial intelligence Trinity would be listening. The AI inhabited the destroyer, formerly called Griffin, docked with Indomitable's prime section. A voice that sounded like Indy, the machine part of the group mind, replied,
"I am not Zaxby or Indy anymore. I am Trinity now, Admiral. How may I serve?"
"How quick can you get me to the fight?"
"Trinity is the fastest ship present in the system. I estimate I can reach the forward edge of the battle area within 2 hours. If you board me within the next 7 minutes."
"On my way."
Engels was already turning to object.
"What do you think you can do out there that Ellen Gray can't, Derek?" she hissed, moving close.
"You're not a fleet commander."
"Exactly. So I'm not needed here. I can't just sit on my ass. You're the naval officer. You get Indomitable traveling inward as fast as you can. Assemble on the move. Trinity will keep me safe while I observe our new enemies up close."
"Observe?" she scoffed. "You can't observe anything more than sensors collect. Send in Trinity on her own if you need data. You don't need to risk yourself."
"I have to get in there," Straker insisted.
"I will keep him safe,"
Trinity assured Engels.
"I also am interested in observing the Opters up close and adding to my data stores."
That sounded more like the Zaxby part of the triumvirate being.
"There you go." Straker pecked Engels on the lips. "Gotta run, hun. See you on the other side."
He left her fuming. As he jogged toward the flight deck, he called into the air,
"You still wired into Indomitable's nervous system, Trinity?"
If you're asking if I'm still connected to the shipboard network, I am.
Tell Red Wolf to grab my go bag from my quarters and meet me at the airlock. Then pass to the flight deck to prep my mech suit. I'll walk it aboard.
There's no need, said Trinity. I am even now loading it into my cargo bay, having anticipated your desire to bring it along.
Straker changed direction toward the airlock.
Great! Be there in a minute.
At the portal from Indomitable to Trinity, Sergeant Red Wolf stood in his battle suit, a duffel in each hand.
What's in the other bag? Straker asked as he came to a stop.
My own gear, sir.
I don't need you along, Red.
The man's black eyes darkened further.
Ain't I your bodyguard, sir? And your steward?
Straker thought about it.
I guess you are, aren't you? Okay, good to have you along.
Red Wolf's plainer face almost cracked a smile.
Glad to hear it, sir. I wouldn't have to fiber tape you and carry you aboard.
He entered Trinity ahead of Straker. Straker snorted and followed.
Damned battle suiters think they can do or say anything and get away with it. Kind of like mech suiters.
When he reached Trinity's compact bridge, he was surprised to see a young, platinum-haired, ethereally beautiful woman standing near the empty command chair.
"Please, Admiral, sit," she said.
She wore an ice-blue, skin-tight poly suit that left little to the imagination. A sleek headset hugged the back of her skull like a piece of high-tech jewelry. Straker couldn't help but take an appraising look before forcing his eyes to move above her neckline.
"And you are?"
"I am Trinity,"
she said, with a knowing smile and a lift of one perfect eyebrow.
"I used to be known as Dr. Marissa Nolan. My body has been rejuvenated, and my mind has been integrated."
Straker's jaw dropped.
"You're that creaky old woman?"
"I was."
She turned left and right, showing off her body to best advantage.
"I retain all of my personality and memories, so I'm still vain enough to appreciate being a knockout again. I was quite the heartbreaker in my younger days."
"I imagine," Straker said, mentally reminding himself once again that he was happily married. "Feel free to wear something a little less
sexually arousing."
Straker made an exasperated sound. "Forget it. Let's get underway."
"We're already accelerating at maximum, Admiral," she replied. "Interacting with you socially takes only a tiny percentage of my attention, so there's been no delay."
"Right." She was just as much a part of Trinity as Zaxby or Indy, though it was hard to remember that right now.
"Good. Fine. But seriously, you make it difficult for me when you act this way, like a Tashina clone."
The Marissa body's face fell.
"I take your point, and I apologize."
She turned and walked out. Maybe she was merely doing as he asked, or maybe she had her feelings hurt. If so, she needed to grow up. A rejuvenated 100-year-old woman should know better, even if she did share a brain with a teenaged AI and the non-human Zaxby. Nolan looked just as good from behind. Straker shook his head and thought of cold showers. When that didn't work, he mentally superimposed Carla's image on Marissa's, and then turned his face to the main holoplate. "Give me a view of the upcoming engagement."
"Of course, Admiral,"
said Indy's disembodied, decidedly non-sexy voice. The holoplate showed a swarm of opter drones. Well, technically not drones as they had pilots, but they were likely to operate as drones, expendable extensions of the Nest Queen's will, so he called them drones. The swarm approached the inner worlds in a disciplined mass, heading first for the largest and most densely industrialized planet of Murmorsk IV. This was a small gas world, and the main shipyards were on the moon called Beta 2. Dozens of other facilities on smaller moons supported the shipbuilding and repair operations. Skimmer booms, tens of kilometers long, dropped from the lower moons, dipping their probes into the soupy atmosphere, sucking up valuable gases. Complexes thrust upward from the surfaces of other, larger planetoids. Space docks and mining facilities and agricultural domes, all the marks of orbital industry. Mermorsk III, a green world, held the balance of the system's population. The two planets happened to be almost in alignment at their closest approach, perhaps 40 million kilometers apart. The enemy should strike M4, the most heavily defended, first. If they won there, the weak defenses at M3 were unlikely to stop them. Straker wondered whether the opters would exterminate the civilian population or merely conquer them. Green worlds were valuable, populations less so. Did the bugs prefer subjects or genocide? If what they'd done at Krasnoval was any indication, they'd leave nothing alive. Ellen Gray's fleet was farther away from the targets than the incoming enemy, stretched into an oblong blob with one end pointing toward M4. Those lead ships would reach the battle site in about 3 hours. The back end of the blob would reach M4 in 5 hours, according to the annotations on the hollow plate. As Straker watched, 1/6 of the enemy began to separate and head toward M3. One nest ship contingent out of 6? Probably. And why? Did they hope to divide the defenses? Straker wondered what drove these opters. Glory? Competition among themselves? Did each queen keep score, or did they cooperate fully and unselfishly? He put these questions to Trinity.
"Hello, Admiral,"
said Zaxby as he ambled onto the bridge. His headgear had become even more compact than last time, a wireless interface to the rest of Trinity.
"We sense that you would prefer to speak to our Zaxby body."
"I like to speak to someone I can see, that's all."
"You could see Nolan."
"I could see a little too much of Nolan, thank you very much."
"That would seem to be your failing, not ours,"
Trinity Zaxby said.
"If biological urges are failings, we're all hopeless, including you."
"Touché. To answer your questions, the opters within each nest are truly one collective society. You may think of each nest as an individual group mind, headed by one queen."
"You mean they're telepathic?"
"Not at all, but like a flock of birds or a school of fish. They are so attuned to one another that they seem to share one mind, and they do use brain-link technology comparable to ours. Unlike humans, though, they have no taboos about networking brains electronically, so when it's convenient, they do so."
"And the nests? Do they form bigger group minds?"
"Many nests may compose a hive, but they do not seem linked. Nests almost always cooperate effectively, like ships in a fleet, but I have seen indications of the occasional disagreement. However, we should not depend on any division within their ranks."
"I'm just trying to get a sense of them. So they do keep control of their own bugs and drones? They're not interchangeable?"
"No," said Zaxby. "Each nest has its own pheromones, markers, and genetic quirks."
"What happens if a nest queen dies?"
"There are queens in waiting, but there would be disruption in the command structure."
Straker stroked his jaw. "So that's a weakness."
"No more than losing a human military commander would be."
"What happens if a nest queen loses too many forces? Will others turn on her and, I don't know, take her territory?"
"Occasionally, but not routinely. There is a natural limit to what one nest queen can control. Hive queens act like feudal monarchs, with their subordinate nest queens owing them allegiance."
"Is there something above a hive queen?"
"There's a senior queen with an untranslatable name. Mutuality databases assigned her the designation Empress. There's very little information on her, though."
Straker moved closer to the plate. "I need something right now, something I can use, something we can do here, you and me, Zaxby, Trinity, to help us win this battle. We can't afford to lose our largest remaining shipyard system. Can we hack them or anything? You're an integrated AI now. You were a good hacker before. You should be a super hacker now."
Zaxby preened. "I am a masterful hacker, but hacking requires access, or at least proximity. I can't hack from light minutes away. I need to attack their cybernetic systems in real time from short range. They are unlikely to simply watch as I do that, though. so the safest way is to join the fleet and become one target among many, mutually supporting with Commodore Gray's escorts.
Okay, so rendezvous with them.
We are on course, and we'll join them in approximately 1 hour.
Straker paced back and forth. Gray's lead forces will be an hour late, though, right?
Correct.
Will the M4 defenses hold?
My simulations say they will have lost 50% effectiveness within the first hour.
But Gray's forces are going to arrive piecemeal, spread out, rather than in one hard wave. Zaxby zoomed in on the future battle zone and extended his predictions.
Correct. Our lead elements will sustain heavy casualties.
How heavy?
Approaching 100% if they fight to the death.
Straker's eyebrows lifted. That's not feasible. They won't fight to the death anyway, not these former mutuality forces, and I wouldn't want them to. What if we pull the lead elements back and thicken up, delay our arrival by, say, half an hour to an hour?
Effectiveness rises proportionally with delay, but the defenders are dying at an equal rate. I have run every standard simulation, and Commodore Gray's tactics appear to be nearly optimal.
And do we win? Zaxby frowned.
The final outcome is firmly within the margin of error.
Meaning it's a toss-up?
Yes, and both fleets will be devastated no matter what.
Straker smacked his palm repeatedly into his fist. We have to find a way to break through. Zaxby, you must have ideas. I remember you saying you used to come up with crazy schemes and your superiors would shoot them down. Now I need a crazy scheme, something that will give us a big win.
Finding a hack is my best chance. If I could disrupt many drones, the odds could swing heavily in our favor.
What about hacking the nest ships?
They're farther away, and they won't let me sneak this ship within hacking range.
We can, if we use underspace. Zaxby's two nearest eyes narrowed doubtfully.
Even if they do not have detectors, they are unlikely to leave us unmolested once we emerge. If you wish to make an underspace attack, it would make more sense to simply deploy float mines. We might be able to destroy one or two of their nest ships before the others scatter on random courses.
A sudden thought struck Straker. What happened to Indy's objection to killing?
It is still there, but it has been subsumed among the three of us. We find it permissible for us to kill creatures of an alien enemy which seems bent on destruction and death of our people.
Good. Maybe we should put you guys in charge of Indomitable again.
We would politely refuse. We find this ship body to be much more flexible.
But it's so small. Think of the facilities you'd have aboard the battleship.
You seek to tempt us.
Zaxby turned one eye away to glance at his console.
We could always scale up. For now, speed and flexibility is better than raw power.
Do you have any more technological tricks up your sleeve?
None usable on such short notice.
What about using float mines on the drones?
We might kill a few dozen, perhaps even hundreds, but this would have negligible impact on the battle.
And it's impossible to float a nuke directly inside a nest ship? Zaxby spread his tentacles.
I've explained this before. It's completely possible to float the warhead, but it won't detonate properly unless it emerges in vacuum. The presence of atmosphere will cause trillions of molecular interactions that will disrupt the precise timing needed. You will have, at best, a dirty bomb. On a vessel as large as a nest ship, that will hardly bother them at all. Contaminating a nest queen may cause disruption, but then again it may not. Imagine a human commander who was irradiated and knew she would die, but not until days after the battle. She would not shirk her duties, and there must be contingencies in case a queen is incapacitated.
Damn it. There must be some way. Red Wolf stepped onto the bridge, his battle suit boots clanging loudly on the deck.
I put your gear away, sir.
Thanks, Red. Straker gestured at the screen and sighed. We're trying to come up with some clever trick to win this battle, or at least reduce our casualties. We're about to get hammered.
I'm just a grunt, sir. If I can't shoot it or screw it, I salute it or paint it.
Red Wolf took a step forward and removed his helmet to better look at the screen.
Speaking of getting hammered, too bad we can't board those nest ships with our suits.
Straker snapped his fingers.
Maybe we can. Zaxby? The possibility exists, but the probability of success is low.
Why?
Zaxby ticked off reasons on sub-tentacles like fingers.
We have to sneak up on them, and we don't know if they have underspace detectors. If we do, we need to emerge long enough to take a final reading yet not be seen. If we manage that, we would need to gamble that the target nest ship doesn't move on final approach. Most importantly, we don't have precise interior plans. We don't even know if the Opter ship you visited was representative of others. You said it seemed modular, so we can't be assured of the layout. Emergence in atmosphere is dangerous enough. If you appear congruent with a solid object, you will die.
The Queen was in the center, and the center was pretty big. That would be our target. You have the data from my debriefing, right?
Of course.
Assuming we don't get spotted, what are the odds of me emerging safely?
No better than 50%.
Straker considered it. He wanted to take the gamble, get in there and fight, but 50-50.
Boss, Red Wolf said, that's nuts. I mean, if it was for the win, maybe it would be worth a coin flip, but we'd only be taking out one of their ships. And do we even know that would affect the battle? Their attack forces probably got their orders. They ain't gonna just bug out.
Despite his hideous pun, I second Sergeant Red Wolf's misgivings, Zaxby said. You'd be reversing your Pascal's wager.
Little upside, big downside. Straker felt like punching something. You're right. It's too big a risk. So we're back to the hacking. But it seems like we could do more now that Trinity is a warship again. You three brainiacs need to come up with something. Zaxby smiled, more naturally than he used to, it seemed, to Straker. The Ruxin was getting better at mimicking human body language, probably because of being brain-linked to Nolan.
Actually, I do have one idea.
Chapter 2 Straker and Trinity approaching Murmorsk 4.
We're in position, Zaxby said from his helm console.
Trinity didn't actually need a hands-on pilot, but the Ruxin seemed comfortable there and ran his sub-tentacles restlessly over the control inputs, like a poker player shuffling chips while waiting for play to start. The main hollow plate showed the Murmorsk 4 defenses already heavily engaged with and losing to the Opter drone swarm. They were furiously defending the valuable shipyards, but it was just a matter of time before they would be overwhelmed and dismantled by the enemy's thousands of small craft. Thousands more were incoming. They passed beyond M4 and now formed a thick plane of battle, barring the new earthen fleet from relieving the defenders. Trinity was embedded among Commodore Gray's lead corvettes, just moments from engagement. This forward edge enjoyed the right of first blood as the small ships opened up with their primaries. For almost a minute, they slashed and burned dozens of the enemies without suffering return fire, for the Opter drones had much shorter ranges. As a destroyer, Trinity seemed a monster alongside the tiny corvettes, but she joined them with her superb suite of defensive weaponry, defensive in the sense of it being optimized for anti-missile use, which made it perfect for this work. The corvettes continued boosting at flank speed, but began maneuvering randomly. Combat sims had shown they would survive longer if they continued to gain velocity to dodge as they entered the heart of the swarm. This gave them a slim chance to win through rather than none at all, which was what slowing down would have meant. You gonna insert into underspace? Straker asked, fingers gripping the arms of his captain's chair.
Never fear, O great liberator. Our timing will be impeccable, Zaxby replied.
Because it looks like we're getting...
The universe cooled, a telltale sign of underspace insertion, and Straker immediately cranked up the heat on his pressure suit. The hollow plate showed the same icons, but Straker knew they were predictions, not hard sensor observations. Trinity steered toward the nearest, densest cluster of Opter drones.
Hackbind away, Zaxby said. Rerouting.
Straker watched as Trinity altered course toward another cluster. When she was just in front of that group, Trinity dropped another hack mine.
He itched to demand Trinity pop out of underspace in order to see if the hack mines were working, but that would be pointless. Once deployed, the tiny, stealthy devices, converted from a variety of probes, mines, and missiles available in Trinity stores, would broadcast highly invasive, broad-spectrum information attacks. If they worked, some of the enemy drones would be disrupted, rendered combat ineffective for at least as long as it took for them to clear the malware. If it worked well, the Trojans, worms, and viruses might even cause the Opters to attack each other. This was the idea the Zaxby Trinity Meld had come up with. The only way to hack the Opters without simultaneously exposing Trinity to mass attack or giving warning of the attempt. The downside was Trinity couldn't test out attacks and evaluate the enemy's responses. The hacks were shotguns in the dark of cyberlink space. Popping up and looking at them wouldn't change anything. And if the hack mines didn't work, at least Trinity could pass through the swarm and try to help the defenders of M4. 19 more of the devices floated up from underspace before Trinity passed the blockers, and Stryker was confident enough to insist they emerge. The seconds before the holoplate updated seemed agonizingly long. When the new information caused the image to ripple and change, Stryker stood and cheered. Far more of the speeding corvettes than expected had survived within the swarm, perhaps half of them. Behind them, each slower class of ship in its own wave, frigates, then destroyers, then light cruisers, and so on, had smashed deep into the blockers, remaining combat effective for far longer than the simulations predicted. "Get me a comlink to Gray on the flagship," Stryker said.
"Comlink to Coriat established, audio only."
The sound fluttered and burst with the static of the battle.
"Gray here. Make it fast, Stryker. I'm damned busy."
"The hack mines seem to have worked."
"Thanks, yes. They disrupted thousands of drones. Pat yourself on the back. Anything else?"
Stryker ignored the prickliness. The older woman had never quite adjusted to such a young man in supreme military command, but she was far too competent for him to take her to task about it, at least in public. He didn't want fawning sycophants anyway.
"We're heading in to help the defenders," he said. "Follow as soon as you can. Anything critical to report?"
The big flagship, with its coordinating staff of hundreds, had a lot more ability to process sensor data, intelligence, and comlink reports. When Gray answered back, she didn't disappoint him.
"The shipyards on Beta 2 are the critical core of the facilities," she replied. "That's where the defenders will make their last stand. Everything else is secondary. Save that, and we can call it a win. Or at least not a terrible loss. Once that's secured, we'll work outward."
"What are the reports from M3?
"They're holding. I believe the swarm sent there was a pinning attack, meant to keep their local forces from aiding M4. Focus on Beta 2. That's my professional opinion."
"You're the fleet officer, not me," Stryker said, trying to give the Commodore her due. He knew how annoying it was when the boss tried to second-guess and micromanage a competent subordinate. "See you at Beta 2. Stryker out."
"Comlink ended," Zaxby said. "You know, Derek Stryker, I particularly like Commodore Gray."
"Oh, why?"
"Not only is her exterior a lovely shade of chestnut that I find aesthetically pleasing, but she doesn't take any guff from you."
"Take any guff, huh?"
"I believe that's the correct expression."
Stryker smiled. "Yeah, I respect her. I know she'll tell me what I need to know rather than be a yes man."
"Oh, yes, I can see that. I can, yes."
Zaxby blinked one eye. "You're insufferable now that you have instant access to an earthen language database on your brain link."
"If you want to know suffering, try living among an alien species your whole life."
"You could have gone back to Ruxin now that it's liberated."
"And miss all this? Pish posh."
Stryker snapped his fingers. "Back to work, Squidly."
"There's no need for slurs."
Zaxby turned up the place where his nose would be and shut up, exactly as Stryker had hoped he would. With the main display now updated in real time, Stryker could do nothing but watch as Trinity's icon crawled across the intervening space and the minutes ticked down. In that time, he tried to make a decision. Should he order Trinity to attack from long range, darting in and out, drawing many enemy drones away from the main battle? Or should they descend into underspace and emerge among the defenders,
to stiffen their defense. Unfortunately, there were no more hack mines, and it was possible the enemy had already observed the results and had taken countermeasures anyway. Trinity still had plenty of float mine warheads, though, converted from the relatively useless ship-killer missiles she usually carried. No missile would survive the thousands of beams that the swarm employed, and would have to detonate early, killing only a few. Better to drop nukes among them from underspace if it came to that. It occurred to Straker that the swarm tactics of the Opters rendered useless nearly one-third of the weaponry of the typical human fleet, the missiles. Railguns were also less effective until point-blank range, as tiny craft dodged them easily. Beams were still effective, but the small size and maneuverability of the targets made up for their lack of armor. Zaxby, make a note for the next message you send to your Brainiac buddies. We need a new class of ship, or at least a new weapons loadout for escorts optimized against our new enemy. Do you not mean optimized? Zaxby laughed a little too vigorously. Now who's making hideous puns? Just do it, will you? Perform some studies, run some sims, come up with recommendations. It may not matter. Why? Zaxby rolled an extra eye around to fix three on Straker. Because at this rate, we may soon have no shipyards. You're trying to be a smartass. That's a good point, but we have hundreds of small yards, usually for building freighters and local attack ships. Include that in the study. I need some kind of liberty ship.
Liberty ship?
Access your historical database from Old Earth, 20th century, World War II, United States of America. Their liberty ships were freighters, but the principle is the same. A ship that can be built quick and cheap. Something with a small crew, very simple and effective, mainly against these drones. Everything else should be sacrificed for combat effectiveness. Crew comfort, unneeded sensors, extended comms. Something like a super attack ship or specialized corvette. Something we can build by the thousands.
I will send it out on the next message drone.
Zaxby tapped the console.
Admiral Straker, I need to know our tactics. Do we attack from outside or pass through to help defend?
Straker stroked his jaw as if thinking, but he'd already decided. If his main role was to inspire his forces, he couldn't very well snipe and pick at the enemy from the outside. Only by putting himself in with the defenders would he stiffen their spines, and, just maybe, this would urge Commodore Gray's forces on to greater efforts. We go in. Get a good reading and set course to emerge somewhere protected, but close to the fight. We'll need to orient and update and then help out where we see they need it the most.
Aye, aye, Liberator.
I'm surprised you're not concerned that we may be killed.
Given that Opter drones are too small to mount underspace detectors, we maintain the ability to escape at will.
We won't be exercising that option. In fact, make sure you don't even mention it. Nobody's going to be inspired by a Liberator who has a back door out of the fight.
Methinks I could not die anywhere so contented as in the King's company, his cause being just and his quarrel honorable.
Straker growled. Methinks Shakespeare is becoming all the rage. Didn't he also say something about the king being responsible for all those arms and heads chopped off in battle?
So he did. Fortunately, I can regrow arms, though not a head. Well, at least not without assistance. The upgraded rejuvenation bay might be able to do it if the brain were preserved. In fact,
Do you mind paying attention to what's going on around us?
Zaxby huffed. Our mind has sufficient capacity to pay all the attention needed, as we're cruising in empty space right now. My full focus won't be necessary until we emerge in the midst of combat.
Fine. How long will that be?
Approximately 56 minutes.
I'm going to suit up. Zaxby's eyes widened and spun with surprise.
You're going to wear your mech suit?
Why not? I'm no tactician, and I can brain link into your sensor feed. Better than sitting here yakking with you.
Of course, you feel powerless. The mech suit will counteract that sensation. However, please take care not to damage the cargo bay with your random flailing.
I don't flail, especially not randomly, said Straker. Just make sure I can control the cargo bay functions on command. You don't want me to have to blast my way out from inside.
I shudder to think.
Red Wolf followed Straker as he headed for the cargo bay.
What's the plan, sir? We gonna drop on somebody?
I'm not sure yet, Red. By the way, how'd you like to train as a mech suitor? Red Wolf grinned through his open faceplate.
Thought you'd never ask, sir.
I can't guarantee how well you'd integrate with the mech suit. It really depends on how you brain link. Some just can't. But at least you can run the sledgehammer on manual now that Karst turned traitor.
I wish I killed that scumbag motherfucker when I had the chance.
You and me both, Sergeant. In fact, you have my express permission to shoot him on sight, though I'd rather have him in my brig under interrogation. I have the feeling there's some interesting info in his head. The door to the cargo bay opened in front of him as the Indy portion of Trinity monitored his movements. Inside, his mech suit lay on its back, its clamshell torso hatch open to allow access. Straker stripped off his pressure suit, stored it, and then hopped up onto his 50-ton combat rig. He rolled into the reclining, conformal cockpit and plugged in his brain link. That, plus the manual activation code, brought the monster to life. Soon, his world expanded. He seemed to simultaneously stand inside a shrunken cargo bay, his body and senses now congruent with the man-shaped mech suit, and also to see beyond, outside Trinity and into the void. He tested the data link feed and made sure he was able to open and close the external doors and control the air pressure. Once he was sure Red Wolf was sealed and ready in his battle suit, he lowered the Atmo to near vacuum. Then he waited, watching, until Trinity approached the swarm attacking M4 and its orbital facilities. A short few minutes in underspace brought them to the battle for the moon, Beta 2. They emerged into a silent storm of chaos and confusion. Thousands of drones swooped and fired, spinning and dancing in evasive patterns that reminded Straker of flocks of birds or schools of fish, so coordinated that they appeared to share one mind. Above him loomed a besieged monitor, an enormous local defense ship second in size only to an asteroid fortress or to Indomitable. Clearly, Trinity had emerged here in order to shield herself with its bulk. Hundreds of the monitor's point defense weapons fired, rippling and lighting up the area with fireworks. Where beams were revealed by the dust they illuminated, Opter drones were speared and knocked out. Where railguns fired, the projectile streams, although launched at high velocity, almost never hit anything. The drones slipped aside like fish dodging the teeth of sharks.
"Worse than I thought," muttered Straker. "Two-thirds of our weapons are useless."
Trinity added her firepower to the local fight and soon had opened a bubble that provided welcome relief to the monitor. The drones were obviously targeting its beam emplacements, surgically disarming the big ship piece by piece. In her former incarnation as the destroyer Griffin, Trinity had been built for this kind of work, a hunter and killer of anything smaller than herself. Add to that Indy's AI precision and Zaxby's years of service at a weapons console, and kilo for kilo she was the deadliest anti-drone ship in human space. She knocked out hundreds of the craft within the first few minutes of the fight, before they drew back to stay out of her most effective range. From time to time, the monitor would launch a missile and detonate it at minimum range. These blasts would catch a handful of drones that couldn't flee fast enough, but this was a mere desperation measure. There weren't enough missiles in its inventory to make much difference to this kind of enemy.
"Vidlink for you, Liberator,"
Straker heard Trinity say in Indy's machine voice. "Put it through." A real-time picture of a large bridge appeared in his optical cortex, a man in a Commodore's uniform sitting in the flag command chair.
"Pearson here, aboard the Monitor Rhinoceros. Admiral Straker, Liberator. Is that you, sir?"
Straker set his feed to show his face.
"It's me, Pearson. Pardon the view, but I'm suited up right now." "You're a sight for sore eyes, sir. And that ship you're in is a vicious little thing, but we can't hold without help. Lots of help.
Commodore Gray's inbound with the biggest fleet we could gather, but she's fighting her way through her own shitstorm. We have to hold until she gets here."
"We'll do our best. But, sir, we've lost most of our senses and 80% of our beams, And these damned critters already landing on our hull and breaching. It's only a matter of time before they chew through our armor. Do you have Marines aboard?
Not enough.
They all got stripped for other sectors when, begging your pardon, sir, but when we were fighting against you.
Understood. Do you have any other escorts?
No, sir. My other monitor, Hippopotamus, is down, and my attack ships didn't last long. We're all that's left. When we go, Beta 2 goes. Hang in there, Pearson. We'll try to scrape them off you. Straker out.
Below Trinity and Rhinoceros squatted the main shipyards the monitor was trying to protect. Ground-mounted weapons and armored turrets fired upward into the swarm. But there simply weren't enough of them. Capital beams designed to cut ships in half vaporized individual drones. But even on their lowest settings and fastest recharge times, this was overkill, swatting flies with sledgehammers, and it was wasteful of energy and time. Now and then, flights of missiles would launch from the moon's surface, but most of the time they would be picked off long before killing any targets. Railguns fired intermittently and with some effectiveness, as it appeared the ground installations had access to submunitions, clusters that would burst and catch the dodging drones in spreads. But, as Pearson had said, the cloud of drones was pulling in tighter and tighter, and at the edges of the rocky plain on which the shipyard sat, opters were already coming in low over the horizon, nap of the surface, in order to avoid the defenses and deploy armored vehicles to assault. Armored vehicles. Finally, something Straker could attack.
Trinity, Straker said. As soon as Red and I jump, orbit Rhinoceros and clean off her hull. Pop in and out of underspace if you need to get out of a jam. Try to keep this monitor functional because when she dies, the shipyards will die with her.
Jump to the surface, came Zaxby's worried tones.
Have you gone mad?
Probably. Message all friendlies, please, not to shoot the suitors, okay?
Straker cued the outer doors to open.
Red Wolf, you ready?
Right behind your mad self, sir.
Go.
Straker launched out the opening and began falling slowly in the low gravity. Too slowly. A miscalculation. He rotated head down and used his landing thrusters to speed up just in time. A hex of 6 drones dove toward him, blazing with their lasers. Jinking with bursts of his suit jets, Straker aimed and fired his force cannon. The needle of armor-piercing plasma ripped one drone to shreds. He added his Gatling to the mix, but the other 5 dodged the stream of bullets. They were simply too quick at this range. Firing the Gatling had an unintended consequence, though. Throwing reaction mass upward sped him toward the ground. Impact warnings flashed in his HUD, supplemented by his mech suitor's senses and instinct. He somersaulted to put his feet down and opened up his retros just in time, slamming into the rocky, uneven surface of the nearly airless moon. Beam strikes punched holes in the terrain around him. Chapter 3 Straker on the surface of the moon Beta 2. Straker stayed low on the surface in his mech suit with Red Wolf beside him. He ran in shallow bounds, his stabilization system and his experience keeping him from flying upward in arcs that would eliminate his ability to dodge. The mech suit wasn't an aerospace fighter, even if it was of comparable size. He had to stay low and use the terrain, the huge rock formations and the pits, the buildings and mining sites scattered around the complex. In this, the smaller Red Wolf actually had the advantage. The battle suitors skipped along behind him, and Straker wondered briefly what Red Wolf could do in a fight where every combatant vehicle outmassed him by a factor of 10 or more. Normally, battle suitors operated in squads or platoons, their numbers, cooperation, and ability to hide and cover making up for their size. But Straker could hardly have refused him coming along. He wasn't sure Red Wolf would have followed such orders anyway. Straker reached an ore processing facility, layered with pipes and girders and conveyors, and sheltered beneath it. Lasers peppered the area around him, and he returned fire deliberately and precisely, taking out 3 of the 6 attackers. Red Wolf fired his own beam rifle upward to unknown effect. The enemy returned fire, hit the pipes, and gas leaked out, creating a cloud that provided concealment. At this, the three remaining drones broke off and retreated. A ground defense beam speared one on the way up. After that, they posed no threat to Straker and his sidekick.
"Why don't they come down and swarm the surface?"
Red Wolf asked.
"They will. I think Trinity surprised them. She's like having a dreadnought in the hull of a destroyer, at least for point defense. I'm guessing they're concentrating on her and Rhino before they come down in a mass."
Red Wolf pointed.
"I think I spoke too soon."
Straker turned to look where he indicated, toward the horizon. He could see dust kicked up by a line of vehicles advancing toward the shipyard facilities. Hundreds of them, he thought. Optical zoom confirmed it. Small, six-wheeled combat cars backed up by light tanks. Just above and beyond them hovered fighter drones.
They landed them beyond the horizon for a ground assault. I doubt our defenders are ready for this kind of battle. They don't have enough troops, and most of the turrets are optimized for anti-space.
At least it's our kind of battle, sir.
My kind of battle, Red. You can't possibly survive in the open against that many. This is my specialty.
But, sir, I see a pillbox over there, interrupted Straker.
Run to it and defend. Do what infantry does best. Hold your ground. Try to link up with friendlies. They have to have at least a few troops, even if it's just the security forces. You're better off helping them. Now go. That's an order.
Aye, aye, sir.
Red Wolf turned to sprint across the broken, rocky terrain. Straker put Red out of his mind and began to run to his right, for the left end of the approaching enemy line. Standing toe-to-toe with such mass was a fool's game. He'd hit them from the flank and attempt to roll them up by ones and twos. This nearest enemy formation, equivalent to a battalion of 70 or so vehicles, had chosen a relatively flat area with a road running down the middle, the best approach possible over the rough ground. Even so, it slowed them down as they tried to keep good formation. The rough ground would be Straker's advantage. Staying low, he worked his way to the end of their line and let them go past. His first kill was their leftmost overwatch fighter drone, and then another which turned to try to sniff him out. He wasn't sure what their response would be to this, for every military force had its own doctrine. He was hoping it would be the reaction of a natural flying creature with a dog bee or wasp pilot to send in the aerospace forces. He was right. The other 10 close air support drones raced toward him, directing suppressive beam shots that struck rock all around him, sending up clouds of dust and gas from the vaporized stone. This was exactly as he'd hoped. With his own multispectral sensors, he could easily see through the clouds while the enemies were hindered and their beams were attenuated. He picked off 3 before they backed up and diverted the armored vehicles. 5 down, 60-some to go. 2 platoons of 6 vehicles each, one of wheeled scout cars and one of tracked light tanks, spread out and moved to surround his position. Rather than let them do so, he scurried to his right and tried his Gatling against his lighter opponents. The penetrators sparked against the material of the scout car and then dug in as he extended the burst at a single spot. The vehicle slewed and rolled, smoke pouring from its burning carcass. This was good news. It meant he had 2 weapons that could kill them instead of only 1. He put a force cannon bolt into the tank behind the burning car, and it too brewed up, plasma shooting from every crack in its broken shell. The weapon was made to take down heavy tanks much larger than these, after all. Straker raced ahead through the gap he'd created, splitting his targeting and firing left and right. The uneven ground allowed him to hit the soft underbelly of a car with his Gatling for an easy kill, and his force cannon bolt sliced through the side of a tank like it was made of cheesecake. These opters make poor ground warriors, he thought. They lacked heavies, missile tracks, and battle suiters compared to human forces, at least in this place. Maybe they had different force structures when planning on taking and holding ground. Perhaps this battalion was the equivalent of a few ships' marines, hastily thrown together to try to take advantage of a weakness in the human defense. And they'd never faced mech suiters. Well, he'd school them now. Racing in an arc, Straker used the rocks and pits to keep solid ground between himself and anything not a target. This was one of a mech suitor's greatest strengths, his near-perfect situational awareness on the battlefield. The combination of mind, brain link, and combat-optimized SAI made his maneuvers as natural as a footballer maneuvering for position on a field, instinctively placing himself